offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Before I begin this week's program of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me again on this journey where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse. And it is definitely indeed my pleasure to have all of your company in this journey and the many, many feedback that keep coming to me through all of you. I'm ever grateful to that. Sometimes when you're really lost, you don't know whether what you're doing is the right thing or not. Not always. Sometimes you say some things which come from deep intuition, but you're not too sure whether it's the right thing to say. But sometimes when you get feedback saying that what you said made sense, what you said we could relate to, it is a reassurance from Swami that is coming to me through all of you, and I'm deeply humbled by that. Before we proceed to the program, some of you have been writing emails to my personal email ID, that's prem@radiosai.org. Going forward, I request you to send your emails to prem@sssmediacenter.org. So that's going to be a new email address. Same is the case with the listener email too. Instead of writing to listener@radiosai.org, you will have to write your emails to listener@sssmediacenter.org. Of course, you can always write your feedback to our WhatsApp number too. As always, we'll start with a short summary of what we covered last time. We are in the middle of the 8th chapter. The 8th chapter also is important for the same reason the previous chapter was, because it gives us a description of the Lord, the Supreme, as well as the supreme state one reaches given a certain conditions. And those are the conditions that we've been going through, especially in the last week. We covered three verses. Verse number 11, 12 and 13 of the 8th chapter. All these shlokas are about the importance of the pranava mantra, Om, and how recalling the mantra in the last moments of life is a sign of a person about to reach the supreme state or to reach God. But Krishna states in the 11th verse that he will speak of that state which the knowers of Veda speak about, the state those who have given up all attachment reach, aspiring for which brahmacharis practice brahmacharya. But we also saw how this shloka is very similar to a few statements that appear in various Upanishads, and in those contexts it is a reference to the Omkara. Here Krishna speaks about aksharam padam, right, which could mean the supreme state which is beyond destruction, or if we consider padam to be word, it also means the supreme indestructible that is represented by this word, and that word is Om. But though Krishna says that I'm going to speak about that state, 11, 12 and 13, Krishna is still speaking about the importance of Om, because he says recalling that mantra in those last moments sanctifies one's life. The description of that state which Krishna promises in verse number 11 is what we're going to be seeing in the verses that we'll cover today, 14, 15 and 16. In verses 12 and 13, Krishna gives a description of what can be called a yogic way of giving up the body, if I could put it that way. Of course, Krishna doesn't say so, but as we've been discussing, this is one of the things the Bhagavad Gita does. It validates the scriptural procedures and scriptural descriptions for some of these things. So Krishna says in the 12th verse, Sarvadvarani Samyamya, having controlled all gates or entrances, which means the senses, Mano Hridi Niruddhyacha, having the mind confined to the heart, which is the seat of the self, Mudni Adhaya Atmanah Pranam Asthitaha, having placed in the top of the head one's prana, yoga dharanam, through the practice of yoga. So this is still not a complete statement, but this is what he says in the 12th verse, the various descriptions. He continues in the 13th shloka, Om iti ekaksharam brahma vyaharan mam anusmaran. doing all this, one who meditates on the Ekaksharam Brahma, Om, and thinking of me who leaves the body, reaches Paramam Gatim, the supreme state. We then discussed the concept of Om, the Pranava Mantra, and what it means to recall it in the last moments. How one must perceive Om through one's life, through the process of sadhana, and how that is recalled in the last moments, and how that is another way of describing what Krishna says, that you think of the Lord in the last moments. It is nothing but what Krishna has been stating over and over again, to recognize the Lord as being the Sarvasya Dharanam, the basis, the Adhara of all things. Before we head to the shlokas that we're going to be discussing this week, we might have a question. Why is such stringent conditions for the supreme state? You should control your prana, your mind should be in your hridaya, you should do this, you should do that, you should think of Om. Why is God making the process so stringent and the achievement so exclusive? Swami addresses this in the Gita Vahini through a question asked by Arjuna and Krishna's reply. This is from the 16th chapter of the Gita Vahini, and I'll read out that passage. It's very beautifully written and pretty self-explanatory too. Swami says, and I quote, Arjuna made bold to put another query. He said, Lord, it is good that those who repeat Om with their last breath attain the Lord, but what about those who do not? Their number is certainly much larger. Have they no chance to release? In the court of the Almighty are only some to be honored with seats? Have the miserable and the poor no accommodation at all? Tell me, where they go, where they will be admitted? Krishna replies, Arjuna, you are falling into a great error. Beware. The Lord does not discriminate between the weak and the strong or the high and the low. Such an attitude will never warp his vision. All are entitled to his grace. All are entitled to enter his reception hall. Its doors are ever open. No guards are there to bar the entrance of anyone. No one is prevented. No one is invited. All are welcome to enter. What can anyone do if some do not approach the door? Those who desire warmth have to go near enough to the fireside and sit there. Those who stand afar can know only the light that emerges from that fireside. What do you say of the person who standing afar declares that the fire has no warmth? He certainly is not sane. All who yearn for the presence, all who desire to enter the court of the Lord, and who strive in their mind constantly for the fruition of that desire, all have admission and accommodation there. Not everyone can repeat Om at the last moment. That is why constant remembrance of the Lord is said to have the power of inducing the Lord to bear the burden of your happiness here and hereafter. Of course, this has to be practiced long. Spiritual discipline gains everything. Strong and steady spiritual discipline. End of quote. A very beautiful passage where Swami says that, you know, we often paint God with our differences and our frailties and our shortcomings. But the Lord says, my doors are ever open, my arms are ever open, but you must approach. As Swami said, standing far from the fireside, you can't say that the fire has no warmth, it has only light. If you want to feel the warmth of the fire, you have to make the effort of walking towards it. So that is what this entire portion is about, where Krishna says, what are the efforts that one has to do? But towards the end of that quote, what Swami said, that I know controlling the prana and doing this and doing that is not easy for everyone. That is why think of the Lord at all times and make it a practice. That spiritual discipline gains everything, not any spiritual discipline, strong and steady spiritual discipline, Swami emphasized. So we will go to the next shloka, shloka number 14 of the 8th chapter. As always, we'll listen to it in the voice of Brother Shyam. I'll give you a very brief meaning of that. Then we will discuss these shlokas. The following shlokas are very, very important. Every shloka of the Bhagavad Gita is important. But everything gives a deeper meaning and deeper understanding that it really is worth contemplating a lifetime on. And these shlokas are no less than that. So we'll listen to shloka number 14 and then we'll discuss about it.
Ananyachetas satatam yo mam smarati nityashah tasyaham sulabhah partha nitya yuktasya yoginah.
To him who thinks constantly of me and of nothing else, to such an ever faithful devotee, O Arjuna, I am ever accessible. So that's the 14th verse. After having spoken about the various yogas and their complexities, Krishna winds up that portion with the shloka. After going through the shlokas, as I was just saying in that summary, we might have thought, Swami, what is all this? Chanting Om, prana should be brought between the eyebrows, mind to the hridaya, breath to the top of the head. Too many things to remember during the last moments, and I have still not even started practicing all this. I should first sign up to some yoga class, find some Himalayan master, learn all these techniques, and then I should remember to do all these in the last moments. Krishna settles all our doubts in the shloka. He says, the one who thinks of me at all times reaches me. Period. But some of the words being used here are important, and they also give us an understanding of what Krishna means by saying, thinking of him all the time. He says, Ananya Chetaha, with the mind not thinking of any other object. This word can be seen in another way too. Though in the Gita Vahini, Swami doesn't give this interpretation for the shloka, he has given this explanation for the word Ananya in some of his discourses, especially when we come to the shloka Ananyas Chintayantoma. We will see that. Anya Chetaha means the mind that is after others. All objects, relationships, friendships, dreams and aspirations, when thought about, the person is referred to as Anya Chetaha, the one who has a mind that thinks of other things. Ananya Chetaha thus means one who does not think of other things, which means one who thinks of the self alone. So that is one of the interpretations that can be given for Ananya Chetaha. But in this shloka, Krishna specifically speaks about remaining focused on one thought. What is that? He explains, Ananya Chetaha satatam yo mam smarati nityashah, without other thoughts, yaha, he who satatam, constantly, mam smarati, thinks of me, nityashah, always. So clearly Krishna states here, those whose minds are thinking of him and nothing else. But he also uses two words, satatam and nityashah, which can be used interchangeably in some contexts. Satatam and nityashah almost are synonyms, but when used together, they convey an important message, and that we will have to take a look at. Satatam means constantly. I can think of God constantly for a few hours or even a few days. I'm sure we all have been through such a phase in our relationship with Swami. You know, when we all joined as students, it used to be like that for those first few months when we were in the hostel, it's all Swami, Swami, Swami. We're always thinking about Swami. We're always talking about Swami. I'm not saying that it's a fake emotion or something, but it was an emotional state of being engrossed in Swami. But to hold on to that state of being or to hold on to being in that thoughts of Swami, a certain approach to life is required. That sort of thinking also has its benefits. Those brief moments when we are constantly in thoughts of God. There was a beautiful incident that one of my lecturers was once narrating. Swami had told in a discourse that when you are thinking of God, when you are performing Namasmarana, it should be like the links in a chain. One link ends and the other link starts. Or even before one link ends, the other link starts. Swami said your Namasmarana should be continuous like that. I think Swami had also said once, it must be like when you pour oil from one container to the other. There are no breaks you can see in that flow. So Swami would say that is how your Namasmarana should be, continuous without having any breaks. Saying so, Swami also added, if you do Namasmarana like that, you will see a tangible proof that your sadhana has reached Swami. Something will happen and you will know that this is a reward for doing Namasmarana in that manner. So this lecturer of mine wanted to try it out, right? Anything that Swami says is true for all times and it can be tested then and there. So he wanted to see, you know, what kind of benefit Swami is talking about. So one day when he was standing for darshan in Trai Vrindavan, those were the days when students used to stand outside Trai Vrindavan, they would not be seated for darshan. So he started doing Namasmarana just like how Swami had said it should be done. And even as maybe a half an hour or 45 minutes went by, Swami came out for darshan. There were quite a few students and teachers standing there, right? Typically there are about 200, 300 students in the campus along with maybe 50 teachers or so. So Swami comes out, all of a sudden points out to this lecturer and calls him. He goes up to Swami and Swami asks him some random question which Swami could have asked anybody in that crowd of a few hundred people. There was no reason why Swami should pick him alone. And as would be the practice, Swami calls someone and speaks like that whenever we would get the opportunity to speak anything. You know, Swami would simply ask, where is the warden or where is the student or where is the lecturer? If Swami gives us that opportunity of sambhashan, immediately we will, you know, tell Swami, Swami, can we take Pada Namaskar? So this teacher looked at Swami and said, Swami, Pada Namaskar. And Swami said, chesko. So instantly he said, Swami showed him the effect of that satatam yomam smarati. When you think of him constantly without break, as Swami said, you will know that this is a reward for that sadhana. So there is benefit even in this short term, having that constant thought of God. We all have had such phases in life, I'm sure. When we first started attending bhajans in a center or samiti, first time when we came to Prashanti Nilayam, or when we started reading about Swami for the first time and so on. Or sometimes when we are under serious trouble. That is one of the times we think of Swami all the time, right? Once some problem comes, thinking of Swami becomes so very spontaneous. And that's why Mother Kunti makes that prayer, O Krishna, give me more troubles, because I seem to be thinking of you only when I have troubles. But with time, we are not in that constant thoughts of Swami. Why is that so? Because other interests take over our lives. Other ambitions step in, other aspirations take root, other people enter our lives, other relationships come to us. But Krishna is saying, Ananya Chetaha Satatam Yomam Smarati. One who is able to think of me constantly without any other thought, such a person will also think of God all through life. Nitya Shaha, eternally. More importantly, till the end. I know it's a paradox saying eternally and till the end. It means all through your life till the end. So, Ananya Chetaha Satatam Yomam Smarati Nityashah. The one who is able to think of me without thinking of any other, and is able to do this constantly all through life. What happens when you're able to live life like that? Tasya, for such a person, Nitya Yuktasya Yoginah, a person who is a yogi, who is ever steadfast in this manner, Aham Sulabha. I am easy to attain. How beautiful is that expression? Aham sulabha, I am easy to attain, or for him or her, I am easily available. One who leads their life thinking constantly of God, reaching God, becomes so sulabha, easy. Forget all this prana, om and breath control business. Swami elaborates in the Gita Vahini when he speaks about this verse. He is putting it in Krishna's words, but just close your eyes and imagine Swami standing before you and saying these words. Swami says in the Gita Vahini, and I quote, I am as near to people as they are to me. My dear Arjuna, how can I forget the one who never forgets me? Forgetting is a human frailty, not a characteristic of God, let me tell you. There is no need for yoga or spiritual exercise or even wisdom. It does not matter whether you give these up because you are too weak, or whether, in spite of having the strength, you do not feel like struggling to master these. I don't ask for yoga or spiritual exercise. I ask only that your mind be fixed on me. Devote your mind to me, dedicate it to me. That is all I ask for. End of quote. Can it be more easy than this? There are many times I wondered if Swami had professed some very tough tapas or yogic practice, would people like me be able to measure up to Swami's expectations? I think it is taking pity on people like me that Swami must have made it so simple, isn't it? First, he takes a form that is so lovable, that is so enchanting, and he touches so many lives in so many ways. He allows us to know those stories, allows us to know him through these many devotees and their experiences. And then he says, all you have to do is just love me and think of me. It would be ridiculous on our part to ask Swami to make it even simpler than this, isn't it? Later in the 17th chapter of the Gita Vahini, Swami goes on to say, if even this much you are not able to do, you must ask yourself, what then is your spiritual sadhana capable of? If you still feel you don't have the strength of mind, Swami says, ask yourself, where do you get the strength of mind to pursue the world and its pleasures? Can't you divert that strength towards God? How true is that? We often speak of, you know, these kind of temporary vairagyas. When we pursue something and don't get it, for that period of time, we get that disgust and say that, oh, I don't need this, I'll give it up. You know, you're trying to, some relationship or some friend or somebody betrays you, then you kind of get that vairagya that, oh, I will not depend on anybody, I don't have any friends, I don't have any relatives. But after some time, we again pursue those things. We fail at a business, we try another business. We fail at one investment, we get some more money, we again invest. Till the body says, enough is enough, we pursue pleasures and luxuries. But when it comes to pursuing God, when it comes to spirituality, why should we give up at the first failure? When we are trying to transform our character and nature, why should we give up at the first roadblock? We all are carrying lifetimes of vasanas. It is not going to be all that simple and easy. So it indeed calls for resilience and perseverance. And we certainly have it in us, right? Swami would often say, if people say, Swami, please give us the strength, Swami would say, Kaval Sina Shakti Chanu, I have given you all the strength that is necessary. Why then do we give up this path so easily? Swami explains in the Gita, it's because you don't give it the value that is due to it. Swami says, and I quote, in their eyes, salvation is as cheap and easy to attain as greens in the vegetable market. They seek to escape from bondage as easily as that. They do not yearn much, but they desire to earn much in the spiritual field. They are sunk more in tamas than in tapas, in dullness than in spiritual penance. But they wish for the fruits that only spiritual penance can offer. End of quote. So the first thing we all must do is this: impress upon our own minds the value of what we are pursuing. I always say this to myself, and I always say this to people who say, oh, I'm struggling and I'm failing in the spiritual path. After all, for a worldly college degree, I was ready to go through 15, 16 years of education. When I'm seeking God, even if I were to spend this entire lifetime, isn't it still worth it? We must keep reminding ourselves that. Swami would often speak of the various aspects of the mind, what is referred to as the antakaranas, manas, buddhi, chitta and ahankara. Our manas and chitta, the working conscious mind, and the chitta, the memory with all its tendencies, will keep drawing the mind away from the spiritual journey. But every now and then, we must stop and reason with the buddhi, the intellect. What am I here for? What is the purpose of all this? Is it really worth it to go after these pleasures and luxuries and these power and position? When we keep realigning ourselves, we will get up and walk every time we falter. As they say, falling and failing is not a mistake, but to not get up after falling is a mistake. That shloka Krishna had said, Aham Sulabha, I am easy to attain. He didn't say you will attain me when you live a life thinking of me all the time, which means this sort of devotion itself may not attain the highest state, but when you have lived in this manner, attaining it becomes easy, natural. Swami says in the Gita Vahini, those prompted by genuine desire for the fruit must overcome all obstacles and temptations, doubts and disappointments, and dwell on the thought of the Lord. Then the Lord will not keep apart. He will confer on that aspirant the status of sameness described as Aham Brahmasmi, I am divine. And the aspirant will be contemplating this unity without a break. End of quote. It becomes easy because, Swami says, the Lord will himself confer the status of Aham Brahmasmi, that unity. This is a word Swami is giving us. For the one who thinks only of me, lives only by me and for me, I will give everything, including the highest oneness. In fact, the thought for the day in Prashanti Nilayam that we had here yesterday, for those of you who are getting mails through our Sai Inspires mailing service must have read this. Swami encapsulate all that we have been discussing in that passage that was shared yesterday. Before we move to the next shloka, permit me, dear listeners, to read that passage once. This is from a discourse that Swami delivered on January 19th, 1986. Swami says, and I quote, "The heart of the devotee flows with love of the Lord through constant remembrance and recitation of his name. Out of the stream of love, devotion emerges. One who is nourished by the nectar of devotion will have no desire for anything else. Affection, attachment and desire are natural qualities in man. When these qualities are directed towards God, and when one is continuously engaged in good deeds, these qualities acquire purity and sacredness. The devotee is ever conscious that the universe is a manifestation of the divine and is permeated by him. His life is based on the recognition of the immanence of God in everything. This state of mind is called Prema Advaitam, unity in love. Through this love, the devotee experiences this oneness with the divine. Enjoying the bliss of this experience, the devotee does not even desire liberation from birth and death. Unremitting love of the Lord is everything for him. Such devotion is known as Ananya Bhakti, total devotion to one and one alone." End of quote. So very beautifully Swami summarizes whatever we've been discussing, right? When the devotee has a love for God, he gives up all desires, including the desire for moksha. And in the process, he reaches the state of Prema Dvaitam, the non-dual state reached through love. the love, the unity that is reached through love. And in this state, this is what is referred to as Ananya Bhakti, and this is not any different from the supreme state that Krishna is referring to here. So we'll go to the next shloka, the 15th shloka. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss in detail.
Mamupetya punarjanma dukkhalayam ashashvatam naapnuvanti mahatmanah samsiddhim paramangataha.
Coming thus unto me, these great souls go no more to the misery and death of earthly life, for they have gained perfection. That's the 15th verse of the 8th chapter. Before the portion where Krishna spoke about the pranava, he had said, I will describe to you the state that is reached by the one who thinks of me when leaving this earth. So the description truly starts with this shloka. What is the meaning of Krishna saying, reaching me or reaching God? What happens then? The Gita Vahini Swami puts this question through Arjuna and answers it saying, when one reaches me, he becomes a Mahatma, a noble soul. And what is the difference between an ordinary person and a Mahatma? Swami says that while the ordinary person identifies with the body and thinks of himself or herself as being limited, the Mahatma identifies with the soul. And that Mahatma and what happens to such a person is described in this shloka and the next one too. And later Krishna will elaborate the immensity of this achievement, right? It is not easily understandable unless it is explained how grand an achievement this is. But we will first see in detail what Krishna tells in this shloka. He says, Mam upetya, having attained me, Mahatmanah, those Mahatmas, punarjanma na apnuvanti, do not have a rebirth. Krishna doesn't stop there. He describes this janma, punarjanma, he says, what kind of janma? He says, punarjanma dukkha alayam ashashvatam. There is no return to a janma, punarjanma, which is dukkhalayam, an abode of sorrow, ashashvatam, which is non-eternal. So if they don't come back here, where do they go? When you say there is no punarjanma, they're not coming back to earth. So what happens to them? Where do they go? He says, samsiddhim paramam gataha. They don't return as they have attained the supreme state. What is the supreme state? Krishna will explain further shortly. We will just dwell on Krishna referring to birth as dukkhalayam and ashashvatam for a moment. Swami would often tell this, the very purpose of life is to learn not to be born again. And same thing Swami would say in another form, you are born so you may not be born again. You should die so that you don't die again. And that is possible only if we release ourselves from this janma. We refer to all living beings as jantu, right? We've all heard that famous quotation that Swami would often quote in his discourses, jantu nam narajanma durlabham. So jantu means all living beings. The word janma also is very similar to that word jantu because they come from the same root. Swami had explained this during the 1973 summer course when he had spoken extensively about Adi Shankara's Bhajagovindam. Of course, Swami clearly states in those discourses that the work is not completely written by Adi Shankara himself. His disciples also added verses, but they all were inspired by the Advaita philosophy and the path of sadhana as taught by Adi Shankara. But coming back to the explanation that I was referring to, Swami says there, the root word for jantu and janma is Jan, which means womb. So all beings that are born from the mother's womb are referred to as Jantu, says Swami. And why does the Bhajagovindam specifically refer to the period that the Jantu is in the womb? Technically looking at it, the average lifespan of a human being is say 70, 80 years. We spend 9 months in the womb, and even in those 9 months, you will see how many months we actually spend as us, as this Jivatma. It's very limited. So percentage-wise, it's a very short time that we spend in that womb. But why is a reference made to that period in the Bhajagovindam? Because the famous lines go, Punarapi Jananam, Punarapi Maranam, Punarapi Janani Jatare Shayanam. Being born again and again, dying again and again, laying in the mother's womb again and again. Swami explains that one, and this is what he says. We are in enormous debt to that individual who carries us in the womb for 9 months and who also undergoes such enormous pain to give birth to us. That's the reason we all must be immensely grateful to the mother. And the best gratitude, Swami says, you can show a mother who has put up with such pain to make you be born is to take a vow that you will not put another mother through that same pain and trouble. Swami says that is the best gratitude you can show to a mother. It is not about building a beautiful home for your mother, keeping her very comfortable and things like that. You transforming your life in such a way that you are not born again is the best gratitude that you can show a mother. At least working towards that, we should be able to do, right? So that's what Swami says. So to live life in such a way that you are not born again is the best way you can show gratitude to that individual to whom we are immensely indebted because of those few months that we troubled that individual. The second point about being in the womb is this Atman, whose nature itself is freedom and expansiveness, this soul is trapped in that small space. We have the supreme wisdom hidden in us, but yet we have to live through that period of floating in our own excrement. There is a very interesting Upanishad. It's a minor Upanishad. As it says, it's not one of the much discussed ones or much learnt and spoken about ones. The Upanishad is called Garbha Upanishad. Garbha means womb. So this is a Garbha Upanishad which speaks about the period in the womb. And this Upanishad gives a detailed explanation of how the fetus develops in the womb. How many months it takes for the limbs to form, the eyes to form, and so on and so forth. And many of these details actually Swami has also spoken of in some of his discourses. In this Garbha Upanishad, it states that in the 7th month of pregnancy, prana enters the fetus. So literally, if you look at it, that's when the life enters. So the amount of time this body is in that womb is very, very limited compared to the rest of life. But yet, a very strong reference is made to that. So in this Upanishad, it says in the 7th month of pregnancy, prana enters the fetus. And in the 8th month, the jiva gets the capacity to know its past births and it recognizes the Atman as being one with Om through perfect knowledge and meditation. This is a very, very profound thing that this Upanishad is declaring, that in the 8th month, that the jiva in that fetus has complete knowledge of all its past births. And it not only has that knowledge, it also recognizes the Atman as being one with Om, the Akshara Brahmam, and through perfect knowledge and meditation. By the 9th month, the Upanishad states, when the fetus is fully developed and is ready to be delivered, the jiva is completely aware, whatever little was not aware before, everything is known known to it. And this entire journey of going through many miseries and attachments comes to the memory of this baby in the womb. And at that moment, the Upanishad declares, the Jivatma resolves, when I am born, I will meditate on Brahman and I will pursue Jnana. If not this, I will at least devote myself to the worship of Lord Shiva or Lord Narayana. I will not do wrong actions and I will not get caught in the cycle of birth and death. That is the resolve that the fetus, the Jivatma in the fetus takes. But when it is delivered, when it is squeezed through the yoni in that enormous pain, it seems the Jivatma completely loses all that knowledge. This is what the Upanishad states, but maybe there is something more than just this pain, because even babies born through cesarean lose that knowledge, isn't it? But whatever be the case, the knowledge is snatched away from us at the time of birth. So on one hand, putting the mother through enormous pain and being indebted to that being, and oneself going through such pain, we are born into life. And then we end up doing things which only bind us further. That is why this Janma is Dukkhalayam, the abode of all misery. However wealthy be the family one is born into, however noble be the family one is born into, this whole process of birth itself is seen as a painful affair and a dangerous one. That is why a Mahatma who reaches that supreme state is far, far, far better than normal people. He doesn't get caught up in this cycle of birth and death. This body itself can be called a Dukkhalayam if you really observe and care to ruminate about it. This body itself is an abode of sorrow. Something or the other keeps going wrong with this body and mind, isn't it? First of all, it is such high maintenance. You have to feed it 3 times a day. You have to pour into it more times water or some drink, coffee, tea, something. Then you have to keep releasing the waste out of it multiple times during the day. After doing all this and maintaining this body, it is sure to go wrong as it passes through the years. If nothing in the body troubles, the other bodies around you trouble you. People around you start troubling you. The forces of nature seem to conspire to trouble you. Earlier in the Gita, we had come across these terms, Adhyatmika, Adidaivika, and so on. These words are actually used in another context in Vedantic parlance. We are constantly afflicted by 3 types of troubles, which are called Tapatraya in Vedanta. And they are Adhyatmika, caused by one's own body and mind due to sickness, age, aches, whatever it is. Then you have Adi Bhautika, sorrow caused by other living beings, right from the mosquito to our children, to our own children. All the pain caused by people around us is referred to as Adi Bhautika. And the 3rd category is Adi Daivika, the misery caused by forces of nature that is completely beyond our control, what is referred to in our insurance clause as the acts of God. You don't do anything to avoid it. I mean, you can't do anything to avoid it. They are referred to as Adi Daivika, trouble that has its source in divine forces. So this human life is filled with such troubles, and the moment you get trapped in a body, you have to go through these troubles. Some people might have more, some people might have less, but troubles will come. But then you may ask, are you saying there is no happiness in life? There is no pleasure, there is no bright sides to life at all? Of course there is. But then it is, as Krishna says in the shloka, ashashvatam. It is fleeting. It is not constant. And any joy that comes with an expiry date is only misery in the form of a joy, isn't it? But all this gloomy picture of life is not given to make us feel miserable about the life that we are leading and feel hopeless. That is not the idea of the Vedanta or of the Bhagavad Gita or of any spiritual master. Life also has its beautiful moments. Nobody can deny that. When there is happiness, we certainly feel good and elated. But the idea here is to contrast it with what can be gained if we were to become a Mahatma as described by Krishna here. Yes, life has its joys, life has its ups too, life has its good moments too. But what is the price that we are paying, or what is it that we are not pursuing lost in these temporary pleasures of life? That contrast is what is being brought about here through the shloka. And generally, this is the theme of whenever the Vedanta refers to as life as anityam asukham loke. This is what it is. What are you foregoing in trying to go after the pleasures of this world? So that's the 15th shloka. We'll go to the 16th shloka as well, and we'll discuss about it. And with that, we'll conclude this week's episode.
Abrahma bhuvanan lokah punaravartinorjuna mamupetya tu kaunteya punarjanmana vidyate.
The worlds with the whole realm of creation come and go, but O Arjuna, whoso comes to me, for him there is no rebirth. So that's the 16th verse. In the Gita Vahini, Swami says, at this point Arjuna asks, what about those that reach heaven? That is something that is often mentioned in the Vedas and other scriptures, that if you perform karmas like this, you reach the heaven. If you do yajnas, if you do these pujas and upasanas, you reach the different lokas. So what about those who reach heaven? Before we see Swami's detailed answer to that question, that is what Krishna says here. This shloka is a comparison between those that reach heaven and those that reach him. Again, as I said, the magnitude of these statements will be explained in the verses to come. That contrast between the one who reaches or attains a better birth or a better position in life or a better position in any of the other lokas, compared to what one gains by attaining the Lord. Krishna says here, Abrahma bhuvanat lokaha. Abrahma bhuvanat lokaha. The worlds where people exist up to the world of Brahma. This Brahma that is being spoken about in this verse should not be confused with Brahman. Right? Brahman, the absolute, which is one with the Atman, that's a different thing. Here, Brahma is a reference to Lord Brahma, one of the Trinity, whose consort is Saraswati and who has four heads, as we have seen in all our movies and serials. So, Brahma Loka here is referred to, is a reference to the Loka of Lord Brahma. There are many Lokas between this earthly Loka, the Bhu Loka, the earthly realm, and the Brahma Loka, which is being referred here. These are the different types of heavens and realms that people reach based on their karma. But all these positions in these lokas are merely temporary. Krishna says, Abrahma bhuvanat lokaha punar avartinaha Arjuna. All positions in these lokas are subject to return. Punar avartinaha is an adjective that is being used to describe life in all these lokas. The nature of all these lokas is that one who enters these at some point in time will have to return. This, as many of you may be aware, is based on the concept of the 14 lokas in our scriptures. If there is one place you want to go and look up these themes, Swami explains these in Prashnottara Vahini. The second chapter is about the 14 lokas. Because the Swami also explains the inner meaning of these and how these can be found in the human body itself. But the legend has it that there are 14 lokas. there are 7 lower lokas and 7 higher lokas. The lower lokas means those lower than the earthly realm. They are, Swami writes, Atala, Vitala, Sutala, Talatala, Rasatala, Mahatala and Patala. Then you have the higher lokas starting from the earth, earth being number 1 and 7 more, which are Bhuloka, Bhuvarloka, Suvarloka, Maharloka, Jnanaloka, Tapoloka and Satyaloka. In this, Satyaloka is considered the loka of Lord Brahma. Through tapas, through yajnas, through various karmas, one can raise up to the Brahma loka, the Satyaloka. As Swami would say, it is like getting elected to the Lok Sabha or the parliament. You have a fixed tenure after which you have to abdicate the seat and you have to come back to earn the votes of the people. So if you reach any of these lokas, however grand they may be, however pleasurable they may be, they come with an expiry date. After that, you have to give up those lokas, come back and perform karma to re-enter those lokas if that is what you wish. What is this return? Right? You will return. Where do you return? Where to will the person return? You will return to ahankara. I think that is the most important thing the shloka is conveying. You return to individualized being and maybe you will also be subject to birth and death in the earthly realm to do more karma and raise yourself again. So to the stay in these lokas may be very, very long compared to our earthly human life. But still, at some point, you will have to return. Krishna contrasts this with the state, the paramam gatim that he's been speaking about. He says, tu, but, mam upetya, having attained me, Kaunteya, O Arjuna, punar janma na vidyate, there is no rebirth whatsoever. All these lokas, however grand they may be, however wonderful and wondrous and fascinating they may be, at some point you will have to again return. You will have to return to Dehabhimanam. You will become whatever birth you are supposed to take in whatever other lower lokas, Bhuloka or lower than that. But Mam Upetya, having attained me, Krishna says, Punar Janma Na Vidyate. There is no rebirth. Again, that Punarjanma which Krishna spoke of as Dukkhalayam and Ashashvatam. You don't have that Punarjanma which is an abode of all misery and temporariness. Swami explains this in the Gita Vahini in this manner. Swami says, I'll just read out those few lines. Arjuna, 2 types of liberation are mentioned in the Upanishads. Liberation on the spot, sadhyo mukti, and liberation by stages, karma mukti. Liberation on the spot is also referred to as absolute unity with the Supreme Spirit, kaivalya mukti. For earning this, no one need aspire to any heaven. They get this on the spot and not by stages, step by step. Liberation secured thus is a possession forever. Only those who attain absolute liberation, kaivalya, merge and become one with the eternal, the universal. The other kind of liberation is liable to change. When the effect of the acquired merit wears out, heaven has to be given up and life on earth starts anew. Such souls know no merging. End of quote. So Swami speaks of here as 2 kinds of muktis, right? One is referred to as karma mukti, where stage by stage you raise yourself beyond the earthly realm. But what Krishna is speaking of here is sadhyo mukti, kaivalya mukti. If you recall, last week we were speaking about the Muktikopanishad, the dialogue between Hanuman and Lord Rama, where apparently Hanuman asks this question to Rama, that they speak about many types of muktis, many types of liberations, entering the heaven, so on and so forth. Are all these same? They are all the same things spoken of in different words and different descriptions. For that, Rama says, there are many types of muktis, but the most important and the truest form of mukti is Kaivalya Mukti. That is what Krishna speaks about here. Swami says that when he says, Mam Upetya, having attained me, which means having attained Kaivalya Mukti. But what a very beautiful way of saying in the previous one, as we saw, Sulabha, Mam Sulabha. This is spoken of as an immense achievement in the shlokas to come. When we say that the position even in the Brahma Loka is not constant, right? It is subject to change. You are given entry into these various lokas and we don't read the terms and conditions somewhere down there in font size much lesser than the rest of the text is written. Conditions apply. So entry into all of these lokas come with that condition that you will have to return. And in the next few shlokas, Krishna is going to say, he's going to speak about time frame, right? When you say return, it doesn't mean that you'll have to return. Today you go into the Brahma Loka and after 5 years or 10 years, you'll be asked to return. We are talking about millions and millions and millions of years one could remain in these lokas, years as per the human way of counting time. So when you say eternity, what that means? In that sense, using time, Krishna is going to contrast and tell you this blessing that Swami is saying, that passage that I read out in the beginning of today's program, where Swami says, I don't ask you to do this, I don't ask you to do that, I don't want you to become a yogi, I don't want you to control this and that. All I'm asking is, think of me all through your life, dedicate your life to me, and I will confer everything on you. Padyam that I might have quoted many, many, many times in this program and the other programs that I do, where Swami says, Chikkina Sayini Vakkaleyaka Chakka Chesukondi. You have got hold of this Swami. Chikkina Sai. You have attained him in some manner. You don't know how. You don't know what good fortune, what good karma has brought you this chance of knowing Swami. Chikkina Sayini Vakkaleyaka Chakka Chesukondi. Without letting go of him, make him truly yours. Poyina durkadu ee parthi suni pada sevayandi. Once this opportunity slips through your fingers, there is no guarantee it is going to come again soon. And in that verse, Swami says, Bhakti ni ichi, shakti ni ichi, mukti jeevchunandi. I will give you bhakti, I will give you shakti, and I will take you right up to mukti. That Kaivalya Mukti, Swami promises. And as Swami said, even now if you say, oh Swami, I don't have the energy to constantly think of you, Swami says, then what more can I do? What more can I do? So with these words, dear listeners, I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. And I join you all in expressing our immense gratitude to Swami for coming into our lives, for giving direction, meaning and purpose to each one of our lives. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment. At 12 o'clock, I'll join you for the afternoon satsang. Till I meet you all next week for the next episode of the Gita series, keep safe, take care, Jai Sai Ram.